Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, March 2nd. I'm Ray Graff. Once again, it is that time when we are joined by our friend Gordon Fricke to answer your automotive questions. Gordon is the owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, New York. Popular show this is. So my advice to thee is to call early. 800-348-2551 is the number. If you have a car question for Gordon Fricke, 800-348-2551. You can also email the program voxpop@wamc.org. If the stack of email gets too high, I won't get to the emails, but hey, you don't give it a shot. Or call 800-348-2551. Yes, kids, it's Gordon Fricke, and he will be here to answer your questions right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call and talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We talk automotive maintenance and repair once a month or so, and the guy who does that is Gordon Fricke. He is here again today. Gordon is owner and operator of Barber & Fricke Automotive in Hoosick Falls, an independent repair, auto body, towing, and used car facility. Gordon has been in the automotive repair and service industry for more than 30 years, and if you've listened to this show, you know he knows what he is talking about. Sometimes, almost disturbingly so, he knows so much about vehicles, and just give him a try. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke, welcome back to winter and welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Great to be back.
Had a couple of nice spring days there.
Wow. You know, that's like too early to think it's spring because we're going to have some cold days coming up here.
Yeah, we are the next couple of days. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. You can also email the program voxpop@wamc.org. And it is a familiar refrain on this show, oil.
Yes. Yep. It seems like every week we get another vehicle with a potential oil-related issue. Either it's almost out of oil when it comes in, the oil is so dirty and so contaminated that it's causing problems with some controls within the engine having to do with variable valve timing. And cars of probably the last, I'd say, 8 to 10 years are consuming oil.
Again.
Yes, and it's normal now. The part of the problem or part of the issue is that the manufacturers have reduced the tension on the piston rings so the engine can move more freely, and it gets slightly better gas economy spread out over the whole fleet that the manufacturer produces, gets them under the government regulations.
Gotcha.
For fuel economy.
Yep.
The downside is they're using more oil. And if you look at any modern car's owner's manual, they're going to say something like it's not abnormal for this car to use 1 quart of oil for 1,000 miles, in some cases 750 miles.
Dangerous because if you go to the oil change place and it says come back in 3,000 miles.
Ray, you're incredible. That's what I was just going to say. Let's say you change your oil every 5,000 miles and your car holds 4.5 quarts and you never check it. When that red light comes on, you have very little time to do anything but shut it off and pull over.
Yeah.
So I have an engine rep that comes in periodically. He's from Jasper Engines. Really knowledgeable guy. And these guys, you know, probably the leading engine remanufacturer in the country. And he's bringing me information all the time, showing me little videos. And it's an epidemic. He said they are encountering more engine sales than they ever had before because we're not accustomed to checking and adding oil like we used to maybe in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s maybe even. So a big issue. It needs to be changed on a very regular basis and checked very periodically.
Back in the 80s, I want to say, there was a product, I forget the name of it, Slick 50 something, Slick 40.
Yeah, whatever. It was Slick 50.
And we would put that in with the oil change, and presumably it was some sort of a lubricant. And it protected me one time when the oil change place forgot to put the cap on the oil.
Yeah.
And I was able actually to get back before the engine seized up and get oil in the thing again.
Yeah, that stuff actually added some chemicals and whatever they concocted to make it slipperier and coat all the internal parts. And I think there was some truth to it. I remember Slick 50. I put it in some of my cars years ago. Maybe you can still get it. I don't know.
I have no idea. Before we get to the phones at 800-348-2551, this came in via email from Chris in Cornwall on Hudson, who says, my wife drives a six-speed manual 2004 Mini Cooper with 125,000 miles on the original clutch. I'm thinking of getting a 2017 Mini Cooper. These new Mini Coopers have a three-cylinder turbo instead of the old four-cylinder non-turbo. Have you found any problems with the new engine's reliability? Three cylinders.
Yeah, it's too new for me to know anything about, really.
Yeah.
You know, Mini is a BMW company, so, and BMW makes fantastic products, including engines. That was their, they started out as an engine manufacturer, and they made engines for planes, and they supplied a lot of engines during World War II. So they know engines. So my guess would be that it's probably a good power plant, but too new for me to comment on because I just haven't heard anything about it yet.
Reliability issues for 2017, you won't, the jury won't be out for a year or two.
Nobody's right? going to know until that car's 5 years old, 4 years old.
Three cylinders. That's, to me, that seems odd.
It's a weird number, and it seemed like a number of cylinders that wasn't going to work well, but they, some companies were fooling around with three-cylinder engines in the 70s and 80s. Yamaha motorcycles had a three-cylinder engine. Some Chevy Aveos, which were made, I believe, in Korea, three-cylinder. So it's not a bad power plant, not at all.
What's the advantage of something like that?
Packaging. It's not as wide as a four-cylinder. Hmm. So you have fewer moving parts, good torque characteristics. Really not a bad design at all.
I like 12 cylinders.
Well, that's really smooth and really long.
Yeah.
BMW made V12s.
I think I drove a Jag one time. That was a XJS that had a V12?
They had a V12.
Oh, yeah. That was fun on the Sawmill Parkway.
And they were so smooth, and the sound was incredible that engine made.
And before you knew it, you were 90 miles an hour, and
oh,
you're
yeah.
on the Sawmill, and that's not necessarily the most safe thing in the world.
Then the police were after you.
Yeah, luckily I got away with it. But I never did it again, boys and girls. Let's go to Ron in Pittsfield. Ron, you're on.
Yeah, I have a 2003 Santa Fe, Hyundai Santa Fe. Very difficult to start after filling it up. And lately, if it doesn't run for very long, I try to shut it off. It doesn't shut off fully until it gets ready to, well, you just have to keep starting it and hope that it keeps running, and after it runs, it's fine.
So, Ron, the issue is you go to the gas station, fill it, and that's when you have starting problems?
Yeah, and I've tried to, a couple times I've done it a couple gallons short of filling it, and it's still a problem.
Yeah.
You have to crank it and then put the, I really don't understand if there's any pattern.
Ron, is the check engine light on?
No.
It isn't? Because there's some valving that when you fill the tank up, lets the air escape the gas tank through a charcoal canister to collect the vapors, and it also prevents those vapors from being pushed up to the engine. And if one of those valves, it's the canister purge valve, if that valve is stuck open, when you refill the fuel tank, a whole bunch of vapors get pushed up to the engine, and they fill up the intake manifold. And this is not liquid. This is a gas, but it's gasoline gas. And when you go to start the engine, it's as if it's flooded. That's the most common cause for a hard start after a fill-up. So it's probably the canister purge valve, but almost always the check engine light will be on when that valve fails. Unless your bulb is burned out and your check engine light doesn't illuminate as a test. But that's what's probably happening to your car.
So the way to check that is when you start the car, look and see if the light goes on.
Yeah, don't turn the key on to the run, but don't crank it yet. Make sure all your warning lights illuminate. And that's their test saying, yeah, the bulb works, the system's going to test itself. And then they all should go out after the engine's running.
Hmm.
So that's the quick test there.
All right, Ron, hey, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Our guest, Gordon Fricke, and Don in Albany is next. Don.
Hey there. Got a question for you. So I heard you guys talking a little bit about oil and cars burning oil, so I actually have like an oil-related question.
Okay.
But this question has to do with putting too much oil in your car. So I'm a pretty busy guy. Like, I can change the oil myself, but I don't always have time to do that, nor do I really have the space in the city of Albany. So I take it to a place to get it done. And so one day I got it done, and I was driving my car around, like, a few days later, and I noticed my car was running really, really sluggish. When I would give it some gas, it just really wouldn't get to the RPMs I needed it to, and it was just taking a long time to really get that feel out of the car. So pop the hood, check the oil, and I noticed that there's just a ton of oil, like, in the engine. So on the dipstick, there's, like, a low mark, and then there's a high mark. The distance between those two marks was how much it was overfilled. And okay. So I took it back to the place. I'm like, hey, you guys want to, like, you know, take care of this? And they're like, oh, there's a little bit too much oil in there, about a quart and a quarter, but, you know, it's not a really big deal. The car just burns that stuff off. And then so I'm like, okay. So then, you know, later on, I go to another place, 3,000 miles later, and then same issue happens again. And so when I talk to the folks there, I'm like, yeah, what's going on? And they're like, oh, it looks like our gun is just misconfigured. Like, you need, like, 3.8, and we put in, you know, just more than what was needed. It was, you know, operator mistake. And then, again, they give this conventional wisdom. It's like, all right, it's okay, though, if you overfill, because it's just gonna, you know, go past seals, and the car's just going to burn it off. Hmm. So my question is that conventional wisdom still
conventional?
My understanding is, my understanding of the engine is that, you know, what stays in the combustion chamber should just be air, gas, and spark. There really shouldn't be any oil leaking into there. And also, if there's too much oil, is that going to cause damage to, like, the seals and everything like that?
Yeah.
So
that's a good question.
The seals of the ring. So
yeah,
that's really what I want to get is, like, is that wisdom that everybody's imparting, is it,
right,
like, still sound in this day and age?
Yeah. Okay.
So here's the thing. Is your car a Subaru?
No,
okay.
It is a Honda.
The reason I ask that is, for some reason, a lot of Subarus I find get overfilled, and I don't know if it's because of the range of the stick or whatever, but I see that a lot. And some vehicles hold much less oil than others, and if the oil change guys are in a hurry and they're doing car after car after car after car, and they say, I know this car holds 4.5 quarts off the top of my head, bang, and they put that in it, and that's the car that only held 3.5 quarts, you're a quart over, and they're probably not even checking it. So it's the maybe the hurried up nature of the place you took it.
Huh.
It can stand being a little over the stick. A full quart over is probably too much. And on a lot of European cars, you'll see a sticker on the engine: caution, do not overfill engine oil. Excessive burning may result. Catalytic converter damage may result.
Ooh, that would be bad.
Yeah. So, no, I don't think it's good to leave it a quart over, and I think they should have corrected it for you and said, geez, I'm awfully sorry, we put too much in. Better than not enough, but it shouldn't go over the top mark.
Okay, Don, thanks a lot. My favorite oil story is, you know, my first car was a 1965 Le Mans, and it was Cherry. It had been my grandmother's in the 60s. She drove it probably 12 miles. And so my father, when I was 16, said, here you go. So I'm driving it around. Don't know anything about maintenance of cars. And I knew I needed to get oil. So I got oil and I put it in the window washer reservoir.
Excellent.
Yeah. And so the next time I needed to use the window washer, it's spouted oil all over my windshield.
Man.
I had to pull over, and it was an exciting, learning, teachable moment for me.
Well, I worked at a car dealership in the Boston area, so we saw a lot of different things, but I'd have people come in and say, I think I made a mistake, and a lot of it was putting the wrong liquid in the wrong spot. And I had a guy put a quart of brake fluid in the cooling system.
Ouch.
We had a guy put the wrong oil in the power steering. I mean, it happens a lot.
Well, I learned it.
Yeah.
It only happened to me once. So let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest, and we'll be back with more of your calls coming up.
Support comes from Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear including Zenka from Paris and Coco Song from Italy. Eye exams by appointment. 518-459-2638. and Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches. ColbyService.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff with Gordon Fricke. It's our automotive maintenance and repair program for the month of March, and our number is 800-348-2551. A couple of quick emails here at voxpopwamc.org before we get back to the phones. Gordon, this one is from Josh. Looking at purchasing a new truck in the spring, which one would you buy, Tacoma Frontier or F-150?
Wow. Well, you know, there's giant competition in trucks. They're a major segment. Trucks and sport utilities are the craze. Nobody's buying cars anymore.
Right.
Well, the Frontier was one, Tacoma was the other, and he spoke of an F-150.
Yeah.
So the F-150 is bigger than the other two. A little heavier, a little bit more capacity, conventionally larger truck. But it's just a matter of opinion.
There you go.
What?
Very safe answer.
Well, it's true, though. If you're brand loyal, you're going to buy your favorite vehicle, even if they're having trouble. You know, you're going to be loyal to that manufacturer. He should drive them all and make his choice, because they're all good choices. They're not bad vehicles. So I can't, unless, you know, one of these manufacturers wants to give me a new truck.
And then it wouldn't be public radio. We wouldn't be allowed to do that.
And I'll tout that vehicle.
All right, fair enough. That's Gordon Fricke. And this one's from Mark. In the medical field, you wouldn't go to an eye doctor for a dental problem, and you wouldn't see a podiatrist about brain surgery. Is it the same with auto mechanics? Should you only go to a transmission specialist about a transmission issue, or would you trust any general mechanic with a side-of-the-road shop to repair a transmission?
Really good question, because I'm, in some cases, like a general practitioner.
Yeah.
We can't do everything. There's specialties that we have to send or recommend they go somewhere else. But we do the diagnosis, narrow down the problem, and then if it's an internal transmission issue and it can be solved by fixing it, I'll recommend a transmission shop. If it's a programming issue that requires manufacturer information and computers, it's got to go to the appropriate dealer. So, yeah, if you have a good shop that is well-rounded and you trust them, take it there first. Get their opinion. Because sometimes if you go to the, quote, transmission shop thinking for 100% sure you got a transmission problems, unfortunately, some unscrupulous shops are going to accommodate that thought. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, I get
it. You got to be careful.
I get it.
So.
And, of course, in the case of my van, you'd send it to a vet. So, but what is it about transmissions that are so finicky? Is it the equipment you need to fix them?
They've gotten way more complicated. Transmissions used to be purely mechanically operated mechanisms, even
right.
Automatic transmissions. They are now fully computer operated. So you've got sensors, solenoids, actuators, a computer, and all the wiring that goes with it. So way more sophisticated than they were 20 years ago.
Are they better?
They operate better, but when they fail, they can be very expensive. So
as far as operation, though, they're better today than the old. I like old school vehicles without all the extra computers and everything.
Take the reliability or the cost of repair when something goes wrong out of the equation. Yes, they are more efficient. They propel the vehicle better. They shift down for you when you're off the gas. So, yes, they are better in that sense.
All right. Gordon Fricke is our guest. 800-348-2551. Back to the phones we go. And Elizabeth in Beacon. Elizabeth, you're on.
Hi. I have a question. I've been having trouble with my tire pressure. Of course, in the cold air, my light came on. I topped them off. The light never went back off. And I recently had my car serviced. It's a 2012 Hyundai Elantra. And something unrelated, and they topped the tires off. The light went off, came back on the next day, despite the warm weather we've been having. And I just checked the pressure again, and it's at perfect pressure. So I'm concerned why it keeps coming on and off. It doesn't seem to make a difference if I top it off.
Yeah. What does the sticker on your door say for pressure?
35.
Okay, yeah. So you're using that as your, because I've had some vehicles with higher than what you would normally think the car would take for a pressure spec on the door. And you say, oh, this car, I've done a bunch of these. They all take 32, and it actually says take 38. So you never get the pressures high enough to turn the light off. So I want to make sure you're using the correct number. The other thing is your low tire light flashing, or does it just stay on?
It occasionally flashes. When I turn the car on, it may flash, and then it'll decide to stay illuminated for the duration of the ride.
Yeah. Flashing light that turns solid indicates a failure in the system. Either one of your sensors or something wrong with the system within the car. So it's going to require some testing. What year is the car?
It's a 2012.
12. It's a little bit young to have battery issues. The sensors' batteries last at least 6 years on just about all cars. I've seen some last 8 to 10. But it needs to be diagnosed because you could have a problem with one of the sensors.
Okay. Thank you.
Not uncommon today.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Our number is 800-348-2551. And we go to Richard in Whitesboro. Richard, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question about a perennial problem here. The coldest day of the year, my windows like to freeze up. And I was just wondering, I've never tried this really lubricating the top with some silicone spray, you know, the felt up in there. I was wondering if that might work.
Yeah, that's very...
Or what suggestions you have for freezing windows.
That's exactly what I would do, because the silicone sprays are, they don't stain, they're not petroleum, so they're not going to affect any of your gaskets or rubber. That's exactly what I would do. You can spray that liberally on all the moving parts, wherever the glass slides up and down and wherever it meets, and do that. That's exactly right.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Hey, Richard, thank you very much. And over to Nancy in Wilton. Nancy, you're on.
Hi. I have a Jeep. It's a 97 Jeep Cherokee. And I experienced something that my son calls death wobble. Are you familiar with it?
Absolutely. I've driven
That's
Jeeps.
That's a technical term?
Oh, it's a Jeep guru or a Jeep guy term. And I've experienced it. It's scary.
Scared the life out of me.
Oh, yeah.
I thought I was going to go crashing into every car around me.
Yep.
I mean, just to let people know what it is, I'm reading it from a website. It's an uncontrollable shaking of your entire Jeep caused by extreme oscillation of your front axle, not to be confused with vibration or shimmy. He says if you don't know if you had death wobble, I can almost guarantee you haven't.
Yeah,
yes. Experience
true,
it.
True
it's
story.
Just insane.
Yeah. So what's
the
now, word?
My son is a mechanic, and he fixed it. There was, front suspension. There was ball joints involved. Alignment of the front end. He did all that, and it worked fine.
Yeah.
For about a week.
Ooh.
Oh.
And then it went right back to it.
Ooh.
So what causes the death wobble?
Reoccurring death wobble.
Yeah.
Need a new prescription here. two things in addition to what he checked and maybe replaced, and they get overlooked very commonly. There's a unit in the front end called a track bar, and it connects the front axle to the frame effectively. And there's a bushing at both ends and sometimes a bushing on one end and a ball and socket on the other. And it's hard to test them. You have to test them correctly to see if there's play in them, because there can be a tremendous amount of wear in those and a guy won't detect it. So track bar number one.
Okay.
And steering damper or steering stabilizer shock is number two, because they both keep the wobbles under control.
Well, that sounds like it would be the first thing to look for, right?
It is. And that
steering damper and steering what was the other one?
The track bar.
No, you said steering damper and steering something
yes,
else.
Yes, they call it two different. The same part goes by two terms. You can call it a steering dampener or damper, or you can call it a steering stabilizer. It's like a shock absorber in your steering, built into your steering system. And both fail and both can create those terrible wobbles.
Yikes.
Yep. So check those two things out, and that'll be the end of it.
Well, thank you, Nancy. Why doesn't that happen with a lot of different vehicles?
Because of the front end of that vintage Jeep. It's a straight solid front axle, and the way they hold it in the vehicle is a little bit different by today's standards. It's kind of an old school setup.
Let's go to John in Schenectady. John, you're on.
Hey, hello, Gordon.
Hello.
Hello?
Hello.
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 Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, great.
My question is a cabin air filter. I have a 2010 Prius, and the cabin air filter is like $45, and I really don't want to spring for that. How important is that, like for my health or fog on the front windshield or whatever?
You know, I think they're a very nice item because I have allergies. And this, some of the car manufacturers call it a pollen filter. And what it's doing is it's filtering the outside air coming into your heating and air conditioning system. And they will get loaded with all the outside debris that gets sucked in through your heater. And when I'll tell you, we'll take these things out and they will have so much junk in them. It's amazing that the car gets any air whatsoever. And you can get them.
Wow.
They can be available with activated charcoal, and they'll take out some incoming odors. But no, it's very important, and I think it's very much worth the replacement cost. And you may be able to find one aftermarket a little bit less money, but definitely should be replaced.
Is it easy to replace on your own?
Most cars, it's pretty easy. Some give you some trouble.
Okay.
Might be in the owner's manual, but I doubt it.
I
would change.
Can I sneak in another question?
Sure.
Yeah, bad struts will if you go too long without replacing your struts, can it affect the tire wear?
Yes. Yep. Because you're going to be doing a lot of bouncing. The tires are going to be flopping all over the road after bumps or during bumps, and it'll add to a misalignment of your front and rear ends, depending on where your bad strut is. So, yes, it can affect those things.
John, thank you so much for the call. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Gordon Fricke is our guest today, and Steve, who is on the road. Steve, you're on.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Gordon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing good. My question is, I have a 2007 Hyundai Santa Fe. It's got 108,000 miles on it, and about a month ago, I was hearing this like crunching, grinding noise coming from the left front whenever I would turn different left or right. I took it to somebody. He said your sway bar linkage needs to be replaced. I said, okay, fine. He replaced it. Well, 2 days ago, I started hearing the same noise again from the same area. I haven't taken it back to have it checked yet, but since I'm on the road and I heard the call in, I thought I'd call you and see what your opinion might be.
Sure, yeah. Now, those sway bar links are very, very common on a lot of vehicles, not just yours. So it's entirely possible that that was in bad shape to begin with. But another source of that kind of sound you're hearing, we see a lot from the upper strut mounts, and they hold your struts basically in the chassis of the car, and they're at the very top of the strut. So when you open the hood, you'll see where they're bolted in most cases, and there's a bearing in there that allows the wheels to turn, and it holds the strut and the suspension in place. So upper strut mount / bearing could be the cause of your trouble, and I would have that looked at. And you can, they're not too difficult to test, but you got to know what you're looking for.
Okay, so the sway bar links may have been bad to begin with.
I wouldn't doubt it a bit. Very common.
Steve, thank you so much. And let's see, who has been waiting the longest? Looks like John in Saratoga. John, your turn.
Yeah, how you doing, guys? Gordon, good to talk to you. So I've been in the process of diagnosing a catalytic code on my 2003 Honda Pilot, and I've been learning a lot about poisoning catalytics. And, you know, at the top of the hour, you were talking about new cars burning a lot of oil in order to save a few miles per gallon. I guess I'm curious what your opinion is. Are you going to start burning up catalytics because that all that oil is getting combusted in the catalytic, and so now you're now those are going to last not as long, even though you're saving a few miles per gallon.
Boy,
just kind of curious what you think about the trade-off there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Huh.
Absolutely right. There are some vehicles now that are consuming, you know, quart to 1,000 very regularly, quart to 800. So you're right on the money, because all those quarts of oil going through the exhaust are going to be a little tougher on the catalytic converter. So you will see converter issues cropping up, maybe at lower mileages than we're accustomed to now, and some of it will be attributed to the oil consumption.
Huh.
True, yes.
Good call, John. Thank you very much. Tell me about the process of the catalytic converter. And it really hasn't changed all that much in the days since, what, the Carter administration or whatever?
1974.
74.
Was the first catalytic converter.
And when was it mandated?
74.
74.
Yes.
And so you use some sort of rare earth, platinum or whatever?
Yeah, there's some precious metals in there. Beryllium, platinum. There might be a few more in there. Rhodium, I believe, is in there. And what they do is they make a honeycomb of ceramic, and they coat that with these, quote, precious metals. And when the exhaust stream blows through the catalytic converter, a chemical reaction occurs, and it changes the chemistry of the exhaust gases and takes out some of the pollutants that we don't want in our air. And it's very effective. They really work. And long term, those metals get depleted. They're catalysts. They aid in the chemical reaction inside that converter. That's what they are. They're precious metals.
In the 40-some-odd years since we have been using these, haven't they come up with a different filtering system that doesn't require platinum or beryllium?
No, because these metals have been discovered to do the right thing with the chemistry of the exhaust gases passing over them. They've tweaked them and made them maybe cover more surface area, and engines are running way more efficiently than they used to, and they last longer. They don't plug up anymore to speak of. They used to plug up, but they've made some great advances on them.
Let's go to Rob in East Canaan, Connecticut. Rob, you're on.
Thank you for taking my call. I've got a 2004 Mini Cooper S that had its electric power steering pump replaced as part of a warranty program by Mini Cooper about a year ago. And recently, the power steering started to fail again, on again, off again, on again, off again. And trying to deal with the particular dealer was not successful in getting them to try to address what the problem might be. So I'm now at the point where I'm also getting a dashboard full of warning lights telling me that my electronic traction control is engaged. I've got low tire pressure, service engine warning light. My tachometer goes on, goes off, goes on, goes off. And someone suggested to testing the electrical system. My local mechanic said that he tested the battery and the alternator was working fine. And tomorrow goes to a different Mini dealer, and I want to steer him in the right direction. And the power steering unit still goes on and off by itself. And I'm just wondering if you had any suggestions as to what to start, where would we start looking at?
Yeah, I think that all of your symptoms they're not all related. Some of them are. The low tire light and traction could be. Check engine light is not going to get a reading on that car regarding the steering. The tach not working. Yeah, I don't know. It's going to require, they're going to have to go through one system at a time and extract codes and do some diagnosis work. And I think they will find that probably a few of these problems all stem from one cause.
Connected.
I would think so. What that is, I can't tell you, but it could be a bad electrical connection somewhere that's affecting several systems. I know they extended the warranty on that power steering. It's an electric hydraulic steering system. So when you turn the wheel, it turns a motor on that makes pressure to help steer the car. And I know Vinny had a lot of trouble with those systems, but I don't think that recall involved the steering rack itself. Mm. They can tell you better, but I think they're going to have to dive in one system at a time and try to sort it out.
Gordon Fricke is our guest. We have to take a break here. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number, and we'll be right back with the home stretch.
Support comes from the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York. Working on land protection projects that safeguard the water quality of Lake George. Hiking maps, public events, and more at lglc.org. Union College Concert Series, presenting the Doric String Quartet. The British Quartet performs works by Haydn and Bartok with Schubert's late G major quartet. Friday, March 10th, 7:30 p.m., unioncollegeconcerts.org. Nine Pin Cider, Albany. Hard cider made from local apples. Tasting room featuring New York cider, beer, wine, and spirits, Wednesday through Sunday. Be revolutionary, consider the apple. Ninepincider.com. And watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com.
Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 2:42 is the time on a Thursday afternoon. Gordon Fricke is our guest. And before we get back to the phones, Gordon, a couple of quick emails here. This one's from Jeremy. A lot of questions about Mini Coopers, or wow. Cooper Minis, as I call them. Considering purchasing a used Mini Cooper S, some friends have raised questions around reliability and repair expenses. I find that the selling price points for used models seem fairly reasonable. Your thoughts? I would also be curious as to your thoughts about turbocharged versus supercharged.
Yeah, they're a cool little car. They're very fun to drive, and the S models are six speeds with a supercharged engine. They're like a street-legal go-kart.
They're cool.
They are fun. And they're pretty sturdy, robust little cars. They got way more technical in 2000 and, I believe, 7. And you can tell by the... It went from a regular key to start it to a button that you throw, push, put in the dash and push like a fob.
Oh, I hate that.
And when that happened, they did a lot of changes to the car. Variable cam timing, a lot more electronics. So what, I don't know what years of cars he's interested in, but if he's thinking about up to an 06, they're less technical cars and can be less trouble to keep on the road.
What about a turbocharged versus supercharged?
Two different means of pumping more air to the engine. And the supercharger is simply driven primarily by a belt. It's linked to the engine. It's turning with the engine, where the turbocharger gets its boost from the exhaust gases passing through what's called a turbocharger, which is an air pump. And they both do the same thing, but they do it in different ways. Mm. And car manufacturers have used both. And some have gone from turbos to supers back to turbos.
So, what do you prefer?
Oh, boy, it's a flip of the coin. The turbocharger doesn't cost you any extra power to operate it, but there's a little bit of lag there, and there's some heat issues, and they can leak oil, and if they fail, they're expensive, where the supercharger's a little bit simpler. They both boost the engine.
What a nice 911 turbo, though. Boy, huh?
Huh? If you're buying one of those, you're not worried about those other things. You just want to go.
All right. This one's from Nick. I'm having an ongoing issue with my car, 2007 Audi wagon, poisoning me in some way while driving, and air fans are on and off. The filter has been changed 3 times. No sign of animal infestation, but something odorless is giving me an allergy-type reaction, sinus, chest ache, but also feeling sick, like flu, paint vapor inhalation. The dealership and local guy has looked at this, but it still persists. Any ideas what to look for? I can sit in the car and it's fine, but the minute it runs and goes down the road, even with the fan off, but to a lesser degree, it's making me sick.
Interesting. Does it tell you there what year that car was? I know you put the paper away just now.
Yeah, catch it after I recycle it. 2007 Audi wagon.
Okay. There was some issues with those cars with the cowl vents plugging and causing water to back up, and some of the water would sneak into the cabin, get on the floor, and make mold and mildew and smell.
Oh.
And they also had some sunroof drain issues, which would do the same thing. I don't know if he's got stagnant water under the carpets that is getting nasty and causing him to have those issues, as in mold, mildew, that kind of thing.
But if it's to a greater extent what the fan is on, is there any spot in the air ducts where water might collect?
Yes, that's the first one. That's the plugged up cowl drains, because the water will rise up under the hood where the battery is located and soak the cabin filter, which an earlier caller had asked about. And that cabin filter is going to be soaking wet, and all the junk that's accumulated on it will get drawn into the cabin.
So even if he replaces the filter three times, as he says he did, theoretically, if it gets wet right away,
it's an easy test. You put a garden hose in it and see if the water doesn't drain out.
Well, I'll be darned. All right, back to the phones quickly we go. And Stephen in Lake George. Stephen.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I choose my cars usually based on both purchase and operational efficiency. I don't have to haul a lot. So I'm in a Scion IA right now with a Mazda engine that's giving me 50 to 55 miles to the gallon. It's a nice little car. I'm planning, however, in getting rid of it and getting either a hybrid, probably, or maybe an electric. My question is, since about a year ago, I recorded my mileage and kept track of it for an entire year and found that on a daily basis, I was 9 out of 10 days driving less than 40 miles. If I were to buy a Chevy Volt, I could easily, most of the time, drive it on electric alone, in which case I'd rarely be using the gasoline supplement engine. If that's happening, would I essentially never have to bring the engine in to get checked, but maybe once every 5 years, other than for replacing old fluids periodically?
Yeah, good question. The less that engine runs, the less things are going to wear out on it, for sure. And I don't know the maintenance schedules on the Volts, because that engine's not being called in as often, I think, as in, on a hybrid car. It's a very good question.
You don't have the answer.
I don't. But I think there's some issues there that, you know, if the gasoline is in that tank for a year,
not a good thing.
It's going to go bad, so you need fuel stabilizer. They recommend oil changes once a year, regardless of mileage. I don't know. That'd be a good question for the Chevrolet dealer or forum or website or something.
Well, Stephen, that was a good one.
Yeah.
You almost stumped the band there, although I think Gordon pulled it out at the end. Let's go over to Jim in Adams. Jim, you're on.
Yay, Ray.
Hey.
It's Gordy and Ray, like Ray and Bob.
Yeah.
Well, you see.
But your guys are not only are very interesting and they're educating us and you're entertaining at the same time.
Huh.
Just calling about when I was in the National Guards, we had a truck that came up with a leaking brake line.
Oh, yeah?
The day before we were supposed to leave to come home from Fort Drum and drive all the way across New York State. So they put the question to the whole company, we can stay another day longer because we have to have the maintenance building facilities reissued back to our jurisdiction and then have them checked back in again to the post. Or we can leave with the brake line hammered over and the two guys that will be the drivers will be in line. We'll radio to you when we're going to stop or slow down or get off for a pit stop or whatever and gear it down. It's an old Dodge pickup, standard shift. And then just pull up the emergency brake handle in the middle and make the final stop.
Well, we
opted to leave on time with the brake fluid. You know, there was some in there. The other three lines were working on the other wheels, but we kind of just tended to ignore that and gear it down and use the emergency brake to come to a complete stop and got home without an incident.
Gordon is shaking his head, Jim.
I'm just thinking of liability, U.S. government.
Yeah, well,
that's government efficiency for you.
Everyone in line knew where we were, what truck we were driving. So,
how many years ago was this?
Oh, God.
40? 30?
Yeah, about 35 probably.
Yeah, because nice. Today that wouldn't fly for 5 seconds.
That's a beautiful story, Jim. Yeah. Thank you for that. And over to Jimmy and Rhinebeck. Jimmy, you're on.
Hey, guys. Great show. Thanks. I have a 2004 Trailblazer. I had a head job done on it, and they told me that the engine still leaks. The engine is a Porsche engine. Have you heard of such a thing? The block was made in Mexico.
Well, there is a such thing as porous castings. It doesn't happen very
porous.
Porous.
As, so holes in it.
Yeah, yeah. And
how does it run?
Well, it's not that it's it, the if it there's a porous casting, you'll get oil leaks mainly, or you could get coolant.
So this was by design or a faulty?
No, something to do with the way it was cast. You know, the material. We had I worked at a Volkswagen Porsche Audi dealer in the Boston area, and we had a vehicle that continued to leak oil, and it was very strange until we stayed with the car long enough to observe the leak, and the oil would come through the cylinder head, through the casting, and it would take quite a while. And then it would slowly create a drip, and after the guy drove it for weeks, it would go all over the engine and land on the ground. And it was a porous casting, and we replaced the cylinder head under warranty. But I haven't heard of that with Trailblazers of that vintage. Although,
is there anything I can do? I mean, to stop the leak at all?
It needs to be observed. You need to know where the leak is coming from, because that engine is cast iron. So you can have porous cast iron, just like cast aluminum. But
so something is actually leaking, though, for real.
Is that what they're telling you? Is that what you're having, is a oil leak?
Well, after they did the head job, they said it's leaking through the block, like what you just said, and I just wish I could stop the leak, and it leaks every day.
Oil or coolant?
No, it's oil.
Oil. I think if you really need to get to the bottom of it, the engine needs to get cleaned and then run and watch to see where it's coming from.
Okay.
Can I ask you a real quick question, the other guys?
Sure.
You talked about the piston rings. If an engine's more efficient, wouldn't it be better on gas?
Yes. Yes. The piston rings make.
But not oil. That was the.
Yes.
It's worse on oil.
Yes. Yeah.
No, when you guys were talking about the piston rings, how they're making them today, not making them as tight or seated as tight, so that it'll be more fuel efficient.
Yes. The engine turns over much easier, so there's less horsepower being used up to push the pistons around.
Okay, I was thinking efficiency, but I get you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, thanks, guys, man.
Yeah.
Great show.
Hey, Jimmy, thank you very much. Over to Duncan in Woodstock. Duncan.
Hi, guys. Hi. I've got a 2003 BMW 325X, 160,000 miles. It starts fine when it's either cold or hot, but it hates to start in the middle when it's warm. And I'm wondering, you know, where to chase that. I've had misfire codes, but nothing the garage has suggested has fixed it.
Yeah.
So where should I go?
Check engine light on?
Not currently, no.
And when it is on, what is it? What is the code? Do you know? Is it consistently?
It had a misfire on, like, cylinder 3, and I replaced all the thing outside the spark plug.
The coils?
The coils, yeah. I replaced the coils.
Yep, that's
that
common.
That made it better, but.
Here's what I see a lot on that vintage car: vacuum leaks from the crankcase ventilation system. The old used to be called a PCV valve, which you know, it's a really very complicated thing nowadays on cars. But underneath the intake manifold on that car is a bunch of plastic tubing, and there is a PCV valve of sorts under there. And we've had a lot of those leak, and check engine light's almost always on, and you can get longer cranking to get it to start if that is bad. If that's not the case and that's nice and solid, carbon deposits, fuel injector issues can always be trouble and can be treated with gas additives, carbon cleanups through the intake. You never should overlook a carbon buildup and an injector buildup. So you can start to treat it with some additives.
All right. Well, thank you for that call. And let's go over now to Teresa in Pittsfield. Teresa, you're on with Gordon Fricke.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a 2009 GMC Envoy. And I've had about 4 weeks under repair for a differential. Have you heard of this problem? Is it common? You know, it seems to be a huge problem.
Front or rear?
I think it's in the front.
Yeah.
What is a differential very quickly?
That is what transmits the turning of the drive shaft to the turning of the wheels.
Okay.
Propels your vehicle. In the olden days, like on your 65 Le Mans, you had this rear end in the back of the car, this big cast iron thing with a center in it that resembled a pumpkin.
Sure.
They used to call it the pumpkin. Well,
yeah.
That is your differential. That's the whole axle. The differential's inside it.
Okay.
The vehicle that we're talking about Teresa has.
Right.
I have certainly encountered front differential issues with those without a question. And they usually are the result of the axle seals leaking and never being caught leaking. And then the differential fails and grinds and makes whining noises or snapping or popping sounds. So that does occur. Yeah. It's not cheap either.
Okay.
But it's vital to the vehicle.
I know, it really is. But you said something was leaking. What is it that may be leaking?
Well, we generally see the axle seals leaking the differential fluid out, and then the differential fails from lack of fluid. That's the cause and effect.
Okay.
So that's what usually makes them fail.
Okay. Well, thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Teresa. We got about a minute or two here. Let's try to get another one in. Bill in Pittsfield. Bill, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, guys. I have a 2006 Subaru Forester that I'll try and make a long story short. I'll check the oil one day, and it might be completely full. 3-4 days later, might be half empty. Say if I go on a long trip, a road trip, 200-300 miles, and come back, it might be completely empty. 3-4 days later, without adding any oil at all, it's completely full. Head gaskets and timing belt and all like that was done before I bought it at 120,000 miles. It's now got 150,000. And through that 30,000 miles since I've had it, this problem persists.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering, most people when I tell them that think I'm on drugs, and I'm not. So I'm just wondering, where is my oil going, and how is it coming back without me adding it?
Yeah. All right, you got about 20 seconds to figure this one out.
So three or four things. Has to be on a perfectly flat and level surface like concrete. The engine needs to have been shut off for at least 20 minutes. When you pull the stick out, disregard the first reading, wipe it clean, push it down, wait 10 or 15 seconds, and then pull it out, and that'll be your accurate reading.
Okay. And have you ever heard of this before, where oil magically reappears?
No, but when you check it, how you check it varies greatly.
Okay. Hey, Gordon Fricke, wonderful job, my friend.
Thank you.
Support comes from Stavros, helping people with disabilities achieve their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. Henyon Bakery. .com. And, he said, turning the page, the Hyde Collection, an art museum at a historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5, HydeCollection.org. Thanks again to Gordon Fricke for being here, and thanks to Zach Malloy, who drove the show from the control room, and your phones are answered by Colleen O'Connell. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, Rob Handel and Carol Clement of Heather Ridge Farm in Preston Hollow join us for a Food Friday. Right now, though, stand by for news.